Session every 2 years, the legislature comes together and looks at how they can make y'all's lives more complicated by adding more penal code statutes and code of criminal procedure statutes. So the first thing I wanted to show was a video, a little bit about the process. See if you recognize this video, maybe from your kids or maybe you've seen it yourself a couple times. I think it's 3 minutes, so we're not going to spend all morning watching cartoons, I promise, but just a good 3 minutes.
Whew, you sure gotta climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday, at least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Gee, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, "You're right, there ought to be a law." Then he sat down and wrote me out and introduced me to Congress, and I became a bill. And I'll remain a bill until they decide to make me a law. I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I got as far as Capitol Hill. Well, now I'm stuck in committee, and I'll sit here and wait while a few key congressmen discuss and debate whether they should let me be a law. How I hope and pray that they will, but today I am still just a bill.
Listen to those congressmen arguing. Is all that discussion and debate about you?
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably, otherwise I may die.
Die?
Yeah, die in committee. Oh, but it looks like I'm going to live. Now I go to the House of Representatives and they vote on me.
If they vote yes, what happens?
Then I go to the Senate and the whole thing starts all over again.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and if they vote for me on Capitol Hill, well, then I'm off to the White House where I'll wait in a line with a lot of other bills for the president to sign, and if he signs me, then I'll be a law. How I hope and pray that he will, but today I am still just a bill.
You mean even if the whole Congress says you should be a law, the president can still say no?
Yes, that's called a veto. If the president vetoes me, I have to go back to Congress and they vote on me again, and by that time you're so old.
By that time, it's very unlikely that you become a law. It's not easy to become a law, is it?
No, but how I hope and pray that I will, but today I am still just a bill.
He signed your bill, now you're a law.
Oh, yes!
I didn't hear anyone singing along. Y'all don't have that much energy this morning? Okay. So I show that because I think on the schedule it says that I'm going to just be talking about domestic violence. I'm giving you a legislative update of a couple of the key bills that basically affect your work. And then I'll touch on some additional bills that are sort of tangential in your work. But the three main bills that I'll talk about are I think stuff that you'll be dealing with or that you have been dealing with for the last year since the session was over. I want to preface all that by saying that the Texas Council, we really work hard during the legislative session on a legislative agenda. So last session we had 6 bills that were on our agenda. We brought together experts in the area of domestic violence from all over the state, from law enforcement to prosecutors to program staff to judges, educators. So during the period leading up to session in 2008, we had a series of committee meetings where we sat down and we just talked about like 70 ideas, 70, 80 ideas that, hey, we ought to make a law out of that, or we ought to address this. And there's only one of me down at the Capitol, so I ain't passing 80 bills. And so we had to really kind of narrow it down over the course of that 2008 in order to figure out what was accomplishable, what was the most important for the programs and the folks that were involved, that are involved in addressing domestic violence in Texas. And so we narrowed it down to six agenda items. And I think in your materials there's a black and white version of this. If you're just dying to have one of my legislative updates, I don't mind. I just have four. That's all I have left because I've been going all over the state sharing them. So ask me later if you want one. But it summarizes each of those six bills that were passed. I'm going to touch on some of them, but I'll leave that later on in my words with you. But what I wanted to get across from this slide with my high dollar graphics, did you see that? You might have missed it, is that we go through this whole process, and then we really think that we have a responsibility to follow up with helping folks to implement, to help people know how what the ramifications of the bills that are passed and that are now statutes. In Austin, in legislative land, we like to talk about HB and SB and these bills. And really, in the end, once they've passed, they're statutes and they're sections and they're articles. So I'll try and stay away from the HB and SB kind of language, but I might slip into it every once in a while. So, yeah, that's my... I always look at that, and I think I need to change it because it's like Uncle Sam looks like he's going to be violent, right? And we're not about violence. We're nonviolent, right? Except she looks like she's going to get something done, right? Kind of, yeah. Anyway, I ought to take it down. So that's the legislative update. That's what it looks like in color. I think you have that in your materials. I guess I could use the clicker. But if you wanted to download a PDF version of it, it's available at tcfe.org. And that's what's inside of it. My boss, Gloria Terry, and I wrote that introduction on it. And then that picture in there is Representative Elliot Neistat. And I point him out because he's a representative from Austin. He's a really great partner of ours. But I think he would agree that he's a pretty progressive, maybe even liberal representative in the House. And it's really great to have him as a partner, as well as Senator Jane Nelson, who is from Flower Mound. Anybody from that neck of the woods? Okay, so she rules. She rocks. She's a really great lady, just like Representative Neistat. I point that out to say that the bills that I'm talking to you about, for the most part, passed overwhelmingly in both both the House and the Senate, because there's just a really strong commitment in the legislature. Like I was saying, we had six bills on our legislative agenda, and they all passed, which is anomalous. About 7,000 bills get filed every session. About 20% pass. So it really shows you the commitment that the legislature had to domestic violence. All right, so, and then there's a dork, I don't know if you, a dork behind this. This is our lobby day, our action day with that's me in the background. So that's my claim to fame in my own materials. And then that's all the people that we thanked in those materials. I point that out to say that although I'm lucky and I get to go to the Capitol during session and participate in all the hoopla, it's really the constituents and all the people across Texas that are able to call their legislators to really kind of say, hey, this is important to us, that makes a difference. So if I can call, Stephanie Carr, who's the director of the Center Against Family Violence here, and say, hey, I need you to talk to Joe Moody because he's being a really big pain. Joe Moody's the representative here. Then she's willing to do that. And that's replicated all across Texas. So it just really makes the work very effectual. All right, so those are the bills. Those are four of the bills at the top, the green ones, that were actually on our legislative agenda. And I'm going to talk about two additional ones that later on more in detail. But I just want to point out SB 82, so Senate Bill 82 and House Bill, that's what those SBs and HBs mean. But the SB means that it was filed in the Senate. That was Senator Nelson's bill for us. And it had to do with mandatory probation fees for family violence offenders to go to the local program. So I can give you way more information if you want it, but it may not quite as directly affect the work that you're doing. HB 3303 has to do with domestic violence fatality reviews and the level of confidentiality involved with those. And then 2066 is allows the prosecutor to charge strangulation or suffocation as a third-degree felony. It was an additional tool added, and I'll talk a little bit more about it in a little bit. And then HB 1012 has to do with abduction risk factors, which does affect work that people do along the border. Judges in family law situations are supposed to weigh the chance of one or both parties fleeing to an international location with the child. And so some of the things that one might do in becoming safe after being a victim of domestic violence were things that were included in the statute already that were basically holding it against the one of the litigants. So in other words, if you're getting your passport or clearing out your bank account or getting your important documents together, all of those things before were weighing against the party doing those things. And you can imagine those things may also be because they're trying to get safe from a batterer. So that was changed to just have the judge take into account the fact that she might be a victim of domestic violence in looking at those abduction risk factors. So, and then HB 72 has to do with the 60-day waiting period for divorce in domestic violence cases. That is no longer a requirement, the waiting period, based on a level of proof that the victim would have to show. 2240 is in the crime victims' rights. Those last two, I want to make sure I say them right. No, 2240 is the new Penal Code Section 2511, which is the continuous violence against the family. Judge Tryon Lewis is now a representative in the House. Anyone from Midland, Odessa area? Anyway, Judge Lewis championed that bill. If you commit the crime of Class A assault family violence twice within the 12-month period, it's chargeable as a third-degree felony. So this is different than those assault family violence enhanced cases where you commit the offense, you're adjudicated, then you commit it again. The 2511 is you commit it twice within a 12-month period. And so they're both together charged as a third-degree felony. And then 2236 is the crime victim's rights section of the code, or it affected that. And it has to do with the right to have the court consider an impact of the defendant's continuance on the victim. And so I think that might work, might affect some of the work that you do. But if the attorney for the state or the defense attorney requests, the court shall state on the record the reason for it. And it's for victims under 17 and victims of domestic violence or in sexual assault cases. So those are all bills that were affected by or that were changing to the code during the last session. The green ones were on our agenda. The white ones we supported and we helped with. So I'll try and leave time at the end for questions, concerns, all that kind of stuff. But I don't mind being interrupted along the way if you want. You can break into song. You can break into if I Were Only a Bill or whatever the song was. Okay. If you want to know about any of these bills and how your representative voted for them or your senator or representative, then you can look at legis.state.tx.us if you're sick like that and like to follow the bill all the way through the process. You can look up any bill through the 81st session or the 80th session or any session that they've had. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about SB 1236. So SB 1236 was filed in the SB, yeah, nobody wants to play, Senate, yeah, exactly. It was filed in the Senate. Usually we ride two horses. We file one in the Senate, one in the House, and whichever one gets through the whole process is the one that we like the best, right? That's the one that ends up going to the governors. It's worth saying that you may know everything I'm about to tell you about the process, but it's worth saying that it's an arduous process. A bill gets filed in one of the chambers, and it goes and gets sent to a committee, has to get out of that committee, has to get into another committee called calendars, and then it has to get onto the floor, then they have to vote for it, then it has to get over to the other side and go through the exact same process through a committee, onto calendars committee again, onto the floor, voted, and then they have to agree with each other, and legislators never agree with each other. So you can kind of get the idea that the whole process is meant for bills not to pass, not for a statutory change not to occur during the session. All right, so I was pointing out SB 1236. That's the caption. It's just the quick summary that they use for all the staffers so they don't have to read the long bill, I guess for us too. But it's relating to admonishments given to a person charged with a misdemeanor. So I'll give you a little background about why this is so important. Have y'all heard of the Violence Against Women Act? Okay, well, it's a federal statute that was actually first passed in the late 90s by a now vice president, then Senator Biden. And it was really just the federal government's first response to, at the federal level, domestic violence. And so that is a funding stream that comes to recipients across the country. And in Texas, our allotment was $6.9 million back in 2009. And then as a part of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, Texas got an additional $9 million. So the Violence Against Women Act is a very important funding stream to address the issue of domestic violence. All right, that's the way it's apportioned. Gomer, or no, that's not Gomer. That's, who is that? Andy. Andy gets 30%. The courts can get 5%. 30% goes to direct service organizations like Hope Alliance, which is in Round Rock. The equivalent is Center Against Family Violence here in El Paso. And then those are law and order prosecutors. That's what those people are. So 25%. I'm sorry? How do they get the 5%? Great question, and I'm glad you're asking. The VAWA funds are administered through the Criminal Justice Division of the Governor's Office. And every year, I want to say roughly in December, January, the VAWA monies come available, and people can apply for them. And so that's how you do it. You go to the CJD website and look at the... I don't want to call it an RFP, but it's a request for funding kind of part of the website. And you can find out more about it. But those are, that 5% can be for projects that affect the courts. So, for instance, if you were, I think there's a VAWA grant in El Paso for gun surrender. I think one of the judges has one for that. A couple of other judges have gotten, I think, through the ARA, through the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. I think they got some metal detectors for the courtrooms. So it's a pretty broad kind of set of possibilities, but it's like new and innovative and seed starting kind of stuff is what they're trying to fund. And I can probably, your Judge King, okay. So I'll follow up with you for sure and give you some resources. Anyone that has a question, I'll leave my card, and we can definitely help in that process. I would say that it's been difficult for the state administrators to actually give courts the amount that they're required to give, because it's just difficult for, I think, judges to fit this into all the other stuff that they're doing and to work out the funding streams through the county versus the city and all that kind of stuff. So they're definitely willing and wanting to work with judges that are applying for the funds. Yes, sir. I said tcfv.org, and then I said TCFV, which is the Texas Council on Family Violence. That's the website of my organization, where you can find the legislative update, which is in your materials. And then I also said before legis.state.tx.us. Which is where you can track all the bills, like I said, if you're sick like that and you really want to do all that. I think that's all the websites so far. And then there's a CJD website, but I don't have that on the top of my head. CJD is the Criminal Justice Division, and that's a part of the governor's office. And they're the ones that administer VAWA funds, the Violence Against Women Act. I guess I could acronym you to death, huh? I've got all the CJD, VAWA, VOCA. Yes, sir. Look at him doing all his math this early in the morning. Yeah, there's a discretionary amount that the governor keeps back to fund statewide initiatives and other stuff. And that's allowed by VAWA, by the way. Question? Great. All right, so you may realize, I want to get back to 1236. SB 1236 is related to VAWA in the sense that it requires additional admonishments in domestic violence cases. So you guys probably have memorized this. You probably know it by heart already, right? But it's section 2201 of the Penal Code is where the assault statute is. And in Texas, we have a really long assault statute that affects Class A misdemeanors, misdemeanors against law enforcement, all sorts of, not misdemeanors, assaults against law enforcement. The strangulation suffocation statute is in that, and so it's a big statute. And the one that we typically, or that I typically as a misdemeanor prosecutor used to think of was 2201, the Class A assault family violence statute, which is bodily injury, causes bodily injury to an intimate partner defined by the family code. But the work that y'all do really, to a large degree, is affected by the Class C assault family violence, those offensive touchings, right? And so that is also considered a family violence offense, and it's a Class A. I mean, it's a Class C. Well, last session, we went in, the 80th session, we went in, and because the VAWA folks at the federal government were saying that in order to get your money, you have to admonish all defendants that come before you to tell them that if they plead guilty to a qualifying misdemeanor of domestic violence, that they can never possess a gun again. All right? So in the 80th session, that's what we did. We went in and we put it into the code, and you may have already known this part of the code, but it basically says before someone pleads guilty, they must be admonished that about their gun prohibition ramifications, right? And so the Fed said, hey, that's great, but the way that we term the issue is qualifying misdemeanor of domestic violence. So this is in the G8, G9 provisions of the federal USC, and I can get more into the weeds of that if you want to. But qualifying misdemeanor. And so they don't care if it's Class A or Class C. They don't really care about that part. They just cared whether it was a qualifying misdemeanor of domestic violence. And turns out they were giving us every indication that Class Cs, those Class C assault family violence cases, would be included in that gun prohibition. And because they would be included, we need to make sure that we admonish defendants about the ramifications of pleading guilty to a Class C. And so I don't know how y'all run y'all's docket, but a lot of times Class C folks will get a ticket, sign the ticket, and send in the check and plead guilty and never come before anyone that might admonish them about their gun rights and the prohibition that would result, right? And so the VAWA folks, who give us our $6.9 million and our $9 million, told us, hey, you got to fix that. Some way, somehow, it needs to get fixed. So that's what we did, is we went in and we put this magic language, and it may be kind of difficult to read, but it should be on your slides, but there's magic language that needs to go on every Class C ticket that is issued to a family violence offender. So some people create just put that on all their tickets, or some just have a specific ticket that they'll hand out to family violence offenders. But this is how we became compliant with the requirements of the feds for VAWA. Yes, sir, Mr. Rutledge. Yes, so under the statute, it is not mandated that it be in Spanish, but in most of the tickets that I've seen, they translate it. But yeah, no, the statute doesn't require that it be in Spanish, which is certainly a limited English proficiency, Spanish, any other language. So that language was put on into tickets, and it should be, if you look at your tickets, they should be there. If they're coming before you before they plead guilty to the Class C or any other level of qualifying misdemeanor domestic violence crime, they should get admonishments before they plead guilty. And so we did change a little bit of where it is in the code for those Class A's also with SB 1236. So the great question, what's your name? Judge Phillips was saying that what would be the ramification if we weren't in compliance with the VAWA requirements, and the ramification would be that $6.9 million and that $9 million could theoretically be held back. I'll tell you that they're pretty serious about this at OVW, which is the Office of Violence Against Women, that administers it at the federal level, because last session we were also not compliant around a sexual assault issue, having to do with your ability to get a sexual assault kit but not go forward with prosecution. And so we weren't compliant with that requirement from VAWA, and the governor was getting lots and lots of information from the Fed saying, hey, that money, all that $6.9 million is in jeopardy, serious jeopardy. So that's a ramification. Yes, sir?
Wow.
Man, that's a lot. That's fast. That happened quick, huh? No. In my estimation, this was merely an admonishment about the potentiality of a gun prohibition. It did not change any aspect of the substantive law around gun possession. So there is some question around whether a Class C assault family violence, a misdemeanor in Texas, could form the basis of a federal gun possession case. I think that if you ask the feds, they'd probably say yes, but if you ever look for one of those cases where the Class C assault family violence forms the complete basis of a federal offense prosecution, I think you might have trouble finding one of those cases. So anyway, there's some question about how the interaction between the state statute and the federal statute really work, and whether the official use exemption would apply in all circumstances is kind of separate from this legislation, which just says, hey, there are ramifications around pleading guilty to a family violence offense in Texas, even in Class C-ville, even in a Class A-ville. So I would say that I just went to a gun surrender, a gun conference around domestic violence in Maryland, and I would like to say that there's complete clarity across the country on how the statutes interact, and there isn't. Although I'd like to say it, I think that there isn't. And it has to do with that prosecution stuff as well as the other kind of state statute stuff. There are differences between what the feds prohibit and what Texas prohibits. So in Texas, you can't possess a firearm for 5 years after you commit the crime of domestic violence or during the pendency of the protective order. There's no official use exemption, by the way, if you plead guilty to any misdemeanor, right? You can't be in the military, Army, you can't have your gun as a part of your service in the military or as law enforcement if you plead guilty to the crime. So anyway, does that get to... Yeah, if you're convicted, found guilty, plead guilty, yes. Yeah. Great questions. I appreciate it. All right, so I just want to brag for a minute about our partnerships at the state level. Senator Seliger, as I was saying, Senator Jane Nelson is pretty conservative from Flower Mound. Senator Seliger is pretty conservative from the Amarillo area. He's also the vice chair of criminal jurisprudence. That may have shifted at this last week because they had a whole shift around the committee chairmanships. But if I was trying to get something through the criminal jurisprudence committee, I would want to have him sponsor it, and that's where this bill went through. So it was really nice that he was willing to step up. He's also a member of finance, which helps with funding for domestic violence programs. And then there's Donna Dukes, who is just cool. I mean, just look, like, isn't that a cool, I would say that she is a more progressive representative in Austin, and so it was really nice to have both sides of the aisle just really support a gun, what some people saw as a gun piece of legislation. So it did affect guns, but it was merely about admonishments, not changing the statutes around prohibiting possession. So, all right. And then there is, usually I have a couple more slides where I set it up, but that is a beautiful thing. I don't know if you like Ferraris, I don't know if you like cheesecake or like beautiful islands in the Pacific. That is more beautiful than those are. That is a picture of a finished bill. You can kind of go through and you can see when, back here you can't see it because it's small type, right? But just trust me, it's tracking when it was sent to committee, when it got out of committee, when it got on the floor, the number of supporters. So here in the Senate, it was passed on the local calendar, which is the one where nobody is really fighting it, and it was passed 31-0, and then it went to the House, and it was passed 135-0. So it was like really overwhelming support. But that's there should be smoke and okay. It's like 8 months out of my life. That's why it means so much to me. And then there's the governor. He signed it on in May of 2009, and he was happy to do it. See his smile? Oh, sorry. See him smile? Okay. So like I was saying, I'm going to try and keep away from all this SBHB stuff and use the statutes. So those are the statutes. Code of Criminal Procedure, 1406B, 26.13A, and 27.14A1. For the Class C, those tickets, that's where 1406B is. And then, like I said before, we kind of shifted where the Class A admonishments go in the code, and so that's what those last two sections are talking about. All right, before I go on to... Before I go on, do we further discussion about 1236, SB 1236, which is now Article 1406B? Great. Okay. So can I ask? So I have a question. Have y'all seen this on your tickets? No. Yes. So it's on all tickets that are sent out. Okay. So it's on all their tickets that they like, even for speeding tickets, it'll be on there. So 25 pages worth of statutory language that's required is on their tickets. Everyone else? Anyone else? Yeah? Well, take a look. There's models that I can share with you. That language is very specific, so that language is perfect if you want to comply with the statute. But if that language isn't what you want to use, I guess there's a possibility you could go in a different direction. But what it says in the code is that if you're going to take them and issue them a ticket in lieu of arresting them, then this citation suffices, basically. Yes, sir? So your great question is, and your judge?
Rubain.
Is why are we given tickets on family violence offenses rather than arresting them? Is that what? On Class Cs. I think that's a fair discussion point. The practice in Texas in certain areas is that they're given a ticket and are told to show up later on in certain parts. And I'm not pointing any fingers at any specific parts. But, maybe as a best practice, we think about moving towards a direction where we don't just issue tickets in family violence, Class C offenses. You had another... So the statute is pretty clear about what it requires to be on tickets. So that language needs to be on tickets. As far as VAWA compliance, to be able to bring down the funds that like we're kind of talking about, they don't care how we accomplish it. So if you had a handout that admonished defendants that they could have, then that's also a great tool because then they are actually admonished. Because like you say, on the back of a ticket are people actually reading all the, how many pages, 25? In your jersey? Yeah, no, I'm just... So that is an issue. If you want actual due process compliance with, or admonishments, due process-wise, to make sure that defendants know what's about, what, or at least have the potentiality of knowing, then I think that that's a great resource, is having the handout. Yes, sir. I think that's where the VAWA folks at the federal level are really kind of pushing for it to be a statutory approach so that there is a possibility that it could be prosecuted later. But I read all those. Don't y'all read them all? No, you don't. Like I ever got a speeding ticket. I never got a speeding ticket either, so... Okay, so 1506, y'all might have heard about HB 1506. This is about global positioning, satellite monitoring, GPS monitoring. So that's the caption for those staffers that don't want to have to read too much, right? And I wanted to tell you kind of just on the front end that our great partner, Representative Herrero, who's the Vice Chair of Health and Human Services, which is the organization that oversees the domestic violence programs, so he's a really great partner and a really important partner for us. It was his bill. And then Senator Chuy Hinojosa from McAllen, I just like his hat, like he just wears his hat, right? So he's a vice chair of finance, and he's also a really great partner. I tell you that because I really do trust and thank them for their work around domestic violence for years and years and years. But I also say that HB 1506 was not one of the bills that was on our legislative agenda, and it's one that we helped on, but it wasn't our biggest priority. Through that whole public policy committee process, we talked about GPS monitoring, and we just really saw that there were more barriers to successful usage of GPS than there were solutions for them at this point. And so it wasn't our legislative priority, but we really gave our 2 cents worth to the representative and the senator about best practices around it, and unfortunately they weren't included in what became a statute. So we're going to talk a little bit about the ramifications of HB 1506, and I'd love to hear if y'all are using it in your community, because that's useful. But I'm also going to offer some best practices that I think help make this statute more safe for survivors than it currently is just on its face, just on the face of the statute. So here's just sort of the 411 about what HB 1506 covers. It's magistrates' emergency orders of protection, and those are under 17292C1, right? And then as a condition of release on bond, and that's under Article 1749B, right? So those are the two areas that are covered by this specific statute. It's when you're given a MEPO, however you want to say those, and then also as a condition of release under on bond. It's permissive. It's not mandatory. So it doesn't require that every person that comes through either of those processes be put on GPS monitoring. Permissive, not mandatory. It's very important because if it were mandatory, we'd all be a lot more, there would be more stress involved about implementing it, especially from a fiscal perspective. That's the best way to put it. So it defines global position monitoring system, and I won't bore you with it, but it's basically what you're thinking. And it also says that the magistrate may order the defendant to pay for the GPS monitoring. So as a condition of bond, they can be ordered to pay for it, or as a part of the magistrate's order of emergency protection. And then it also says that you can order that the defendant pay for the victim in the case to receive a little device that would help her monitor. And so, did I say victim? So the offender would be required to pay for that device for the victim. So defendant would pay for his own monitoring as well as the victim monitoring the defendant, which has some issues that I think we should discuss in a minute. Clear so far? Those are sort of the 411 on this. The statute says that if you're ordering GPS, that you're required to offer the opportunity for the victim to provide a list of prohibited places to you so that you know where is allowable under her estimation and make that a part of the order. If allowing the victim to monitor requires you to give her information about GPS, just as a concept, and then also that you can't impose sanctions on the victim for not wanting to monitor the defendant, all right? Apparently that's come up. That was a problem that people foresaw, so they did not want that to be the case. And so it's in the statute says, cannot hold it against the victim if she didn't want to participate in monitoring the defendant. All right, so let me ask you, so if the defendant can be ordered to pay for it, I don't know in y'all's necks of the woods, but in my experience, defendants of family violence offenses don't typically tend to have a lot of money. Is that fair? Typically? Yes? Okay, where y'all live? So one barrier, one challenge that I can see resulting from this statute would be, so there's my high dollar graphics, is that the defendant doesn't have any money, right? And so it's difficult to order it if the defendant doesn't have it because the defendant is indigent, right? And so the statute specifically addresses if the defendant is indigent. And so I think I can, yeah. I don't know if you can see that way back in the back. If you can take just a read of that and kind of, I'll let us digest it for a minute, and then maybe we could talk about it. It's a good question. We'll get to it in just a second. All right, so the statute actually envisions a process by which, first, if the defendant is indigent, then you come up with a sliding scale by local rule, which I don't know that any of y'all, maybe y'all have done that, and then require the defendant to pay the costs in an amount that is less than the full amount, an amount that is less than the full amount. So you've got this company that says, hey, we want to be your GPS provider, right? And then in this specific case, the defendant doesn't have enough money to pay them their full amount. So I don't know if any of us work or know folks in the GPS industry, but that's probably not the best profit-making model, right? So he only has this much money, but he's going to still be ordered to have GPS. So the statute also addresses what that GPS company would do. Just take a second to read. The statute says that if it's an amount, if the guy's indigent or if the defendant is indigent, then the the sliding scale will kick in, they'll pay a lesser amount, and the GPS company shall accept partial payment. Just will. So if it costs as a service, and your question was, how much does GPS monitoring cost? You know, I think that it can vary from place to place. So, you know, you can get the, nobody drives a Pinto, right? You can get the Pinto version, or you can get the Cadillac version, and so the amount of money that it costs for either of versions is, it's a sliding scale, right? So I would say that I've heard anywhere from $10 or so a day, $5 to $10 a day, all the way up to $50 a day. But I don't know if y'all have different experiences or different knowledge about that. How much it costs per day? So your experience, judges, is about $5. And so I guess if more people were involved, maybe the price would go down, and maybe the GPS folks could spread it over several people. The full price people could begin to start paying for the people that were indigent, so that might be an approach. But I'll show you also, the last part of that section says that the county is not on the hook, period. It says it right there in the statute. And that the GPS people shall accept. So the county is not on the hook. I don't see where it says in there that the city's not on the hook, or some other entity is not on the hook, but certainly the county is covered there, right? So that's one barrier or challenge that I think that the communities have had when it comes to who's going to pay for GPS. I know that there are funding streams in Travis County. Judge Denton is a really great family violence court judge, and he has a fund that he uses for GPS monitoring, and he strongly supports that use in his practice. So I'm just saying that in poorer communities, I think that it is a challenge, and figuring out how to pay for it and getting a GPS company, a good GPS company, in that can do it for, you know, a profit, because they're a company, that can be a barrier or a challenge. It's just something definitely to keep in mind. All right. So the statute says carry or wear a GPS monitoring device. Carry or wear. You know, just read really literally to me. If I'm carrying my GPS monitor, just carrying it, and I get tired of it, what am I going to do? So just literally, you know, maybe it's just legalese, lawyer talking, but carry. So I would suggest that if you're going to order it, that it be wear, that it not be carry, just as a best practices approach. And then these are other ideas around best practices. So I would make sure that you make the victim aware that if one of those places that she's listed is a place that she's hiding and that she doesn't want anyone to know about, well then, as a part of reporting this to you and you making a part of either the bond schedule or the MOEP, then you're going to be possibly outing that safe place. So she might give you a different safe place, or she might give you a different address, or just not give you that address, knowing that that's a potentiality. The other one is if you're in Walmart, so the GPS monitoring allows her to monitor if he's close to her. And maybe the Cadillac of the Cadillac versions is that she can monitor it in real time, all the time, right? And if he comes within like a specified area of her, then the monitor might, you know, alert her, right? So the issue is, say she's at Walmart and he's on aisle 12 and she's on aisle 13 and she doesn't work there. Is that a prohibited place, like when it comes to arrest around violation of protective order, for instance? It's not a prohibited place from the penal code's perspective. So if I were a victim, I would, and this thing's going off and he's like 2 feet away or 10 feet away, I get on the phone and I call the cops and I say, hey, help me, come and arrest him, because I'm real afraid. And I think the cops would get there, and I don't think the cops would arrest him at that point. So that's setting her up for an expectation that that's not going to happen. Now, it's possible if she works at Walmart or if he comes near her house and all that kind of stuff, it's possible that then he would be arrested. But I would be really careful, and I would help the victim know that these are ramifications. These are issues to be aware of in agreeing to have that monitor. You know, the Cadillac versus Pinto version is what I've been talking about, but when he comes in this zone that he's not supposed to come into, maybe at her house or maybe at her work, is there a direct line to the police department where immediately the police know immediately and then get in their car and come over and arrest somebody? Or is it the kind of GPS monitoring where you have a beep go off, and then it might go to the GPS monitoring facility, and then they would call the police, and then the police would maybe, you know, put it on a hierarchy of response calls, and then maybe go out there, right? So there's a level of technology and a level of expense that would be required in a really good GPS monitoring system that would be the optimal, and then there's ones that are not so optimal, right? And then the other issue is, now are we requiring that the victim basically step into a law enforcement role? What if the offender does come within that zone or does one of those things? Is the victim required to call the cops at that point, or is it going to be used against her later on that she didn't call the cops, that kind of thing? And then, I talked about the false and dangerous expectations. The statute also talks about whether the victim wants to participate. Yes, you had a question. Sorry. Under the protective order statute, the victim in a protective order that's not the respondent can't be charged with a violation of protective order. Around the GPS monitoring, if the victim goes to where the defendant is, then I guess the GPS monitoring device would go off. But this doesn't have to do with anything around a ramification for a victim that does that. Yeah. A couple of the other things that I wanted to talk about is if there's, in those situations, I don't know about in your community, but sometimes I've heard of situations where people are cross-arrested. So they show up to the scene, the law enforcement shows up to the scene, and both people have injuries and a story. And so the police officer would throw up his or her hands and say, "You're both going downtown." Well, in that situation, the potentiality is that the victim in the longer-term sense and the power and control sense could be then monitored under GPS by the batterer, right? And so in that situation, that's a scary thing when you have a batterer really being able to exercise power and control using the state apparatus, this GPS monitoring. And then I would say that you should have in mind, if law enforcement is in the loop as far as an offender is concerned, then there's a question as to whether the law enforcement could gain access to the monitoring process, the GPS process. So you should really have a plan for that. Maybe have the GPS report to a neighboring jurisdiction or a different kind of jurisdiction, like a sheriff's office versus a police department, that kind of thing. Other ideas as far as making HB 1506 work. I'm interested to hear if you have good experiences around GPS in your community, which is great. Or no experiences? No experiences, it sounds like. Some of the materials that I had, I think, that are in there, do they not address GPS at all? No. Well, anyway, you haven't had a chance to go through it. Anyway. All right, so I'm going to move on from HB 1506 and cover SB 83 in about 3 or 4 minutes, because we're done at 9. Okay? Oh, that's the statute. It's 17292C1 and 1749. I do those checks because it feels like I accomplished something. Check, right. Okay. All right, SB 83. Previously, the statute was such that if you're a victim of domestic violence, you could get out of your lease, your residential lease, because you're a victim of domestic violence, if your offender or your batterer was on the lease as well. So if you've both signed on to the lease, you can provide proof that you're a victim of domestic violence and break your lease, so that then the apartment could go after the offender who is also on that lease, right? It would just be a requirement that they let out the victim. And that was previously the statute. That was previously the way it was, and we really were happy with that. We worked hard during the 80th session with the Texas Apartment Association to come up with something that works for them. We actually sandwiched it, or piggybacked it, that's a better metaphor, on with a military lease termination bill. And so it made sense for, if you're getting deployed, you can terminate your lease. So we coupled those together. The problem was that, there's that. Okay, so you would have a temporary injunction issued under the family code, or a protective order issued under 85. And that would be your proof if your offender or your batterer was on your lease also. That is the statute still, and that was what we changed a couple of sessions ago. The problem was that there's a lot of dating violence victims that are also affected by dating violence, right? And so if you are not living with your abuser, or if your abuser just kind of shacks up sometimes but is not officially on the lease, then those people were not able to terminate their lease. As well as if you're the victim of sexual assault in your apartment or on the campus of your complex, you weren't able to get out of your lease, whether it was a stranger or someone you knew. So you have serial rapists being able to go into someone's apartment, and if they were raped on site, they wouldn't be able to get out of that lease, and that person that they never knew and they never had any idea was around could come and find them at any time. You can see why that would be very disquieting to a victim, right? So the thing that we changed, I'm still talking about the last statute, but they can vacate the premises without penalty. When the judge signs an order described by Section B, the tenant has delivered a copy to the landlord and then has actually vacated the premises. All right, so that's the current statute, and it's related to specifically when the batterer is on the lease. All right, so we partnered with the Texas Association Against Sexual Assault and the Texas Apartment Association to come up with a response to that dating violence sexual assault victim that wasn't covered by the statute. And I can't say enough, if any of y'all know the TAA folks, they just were really amazing, great partners. I don't think this would have gotten done if they weren't really supportive and helpful in that whole process. So I really give them a lot of credit for the response that they did on the statute. So we added, during the 81st session, dating violence victims, as well as sexual assault, but this is specifically the stuff a victim of dating violence would have to show. So she can show a temporary injunction issued under the family code, just like in the other one. She can also show the temporary ex parte order, or she can show the protective order, the 2-year. So those are the three ways that a dating violence victim can prove to get out of a lease. The only other part that's different for dating violence victims is, so she has an additional method of proof, as well as she must give 30 days notice to the apartment. Before, when the dude or the dudette that's charged is on the lease, the apartment association or the apartment had someone to go after to recoup their loss, right? Because there's two people on the lease, you let off one, you still got one on the handle, right? But with the dating violence victim, they only have one person on the lease. So you take that person off, well then they have to recoup their loss some way. So the 30 days was a compromise that we gave to say, hey, look, that'll give you time to recoup your loss. It's not the optimal from our perspective, but it was a reasonable compromise. And so they compromised by saying the 30 days, but then we have an additional method for proof. Does that make sense? So that additional method for proof is only for dating violence victims, those whose batterers are not on the lease. I guess, I say dating violence victims, it could be people that share a child together. It could also be people that are married, but they were not, like, actually on the lease. All right. And then around sexual assault, I know it's small print, and y'all in the back probably can't read it. It's on the slides, and I am less of an expert on the sexual assault response, but the methods of proof for a victim of sexual assault are broader. So what it says up there, if you can't read it, is that you show documentation of assault or abuse of the victim from a licensed healthcare services provider. You would show the mental health services provider, so mental or physical, or they could show someone under Chapter 420 that provided services to them, and then documentation of a protective order under 7A of the Code of Criminal Procedure, which is the sexual assault protective order. So if you have questions about the sexual assault side of it, I would get in contact. I'll give you her cell phone number, maybe not her cell phone number, but I'll give you her contact information for Tori Camp, who works at the Texas Association of Sexual Assault, against, sorry. All right, and there's Senator Nelson, a very nice lady, my ex-boss with his purple purse down there. You see him right there? And then Representative Guillen. That's the Ferrari right there. That's that beautiful, that finished product. Those are the sections of the property code.
No hearing required before you sign that order?
For which order? In terms of, so like, can you? So in a, can you say it a little louder for everyone? Just prior to signing it, she's shown to the she has her 2-year protective order or her her temporary orders or any of those kind of methods of proof, and then she provides notice to the apartment person, and then she gives them 30 days. She gives them 30 days notice, and then she vacates. So those are the three things that trigger that. At that point, she's accomplished that already. Now, if there's an additional process that the apartment wants to go through to make her pay, for instance, or to fight it or something, then I think that's when it might come before you. But the triggering mechanisms are the protective order or those proof methods, and then she would show them to the apartment. And the apartment should follow it because it is required, but if they don't, then that may be a point when I think that litigation could occur. So he's saying that we don't want to have our private intimate conversation, but he's saying it might end up at the justice court then, right, if there's a fight on it. Yeah. There are ramifications in the code around the apartment owner not following it, and actually they're required to have some sort of admonishment in the actual lease papers. I don't know if you guys live in apartments, but they're actually there. I looked one time because I was like, hey, I worked on that bill. I think I have kept y'all, what does y'all's schedule say? It says 9, right? I'm sorry, 7 more, woo, all sorts of time, right? Okay, I wanted to talk to you about then also HB 2066, which is that strangulation or suffocation that's chargeable as a third degree offense. It's in 2201 of the Penal Code. That's the actual language in 2201 that defines the offense. So what it does is it makes that behavior, that action, chargeable as a third degree offense. In some jurisdictions, prosecutors are charging strangulation and suffocation as an aggravated assault, alleging that the hands are a deadly weapon. So that's still possible under this change. They could charge it that way, they could charge it this way, or they could charge it even as a Class A misdemeanor if they wanted to, depending on what facts and circumstances are before them. Like if you had no photographs, late report, a victim that's not on board, no visible injury. Like if you had just a lot of challenges to prosecuting the case, they might make a determination that they would charge it at a lower level than a higher level. If it was Mother Teresa had seen it, and there's ligature marks, and there's a photograph, and there's a confession from the defendant, and all that kind of stuff, then they might determine to charge it as the second degree. But there's those options. So this is within the overall 2201, which requires that someone cause pain, right? Knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly cause pain. And the way that they would cause pain is by knowingly, intentionally, recklessly impeding the normal breathing. So that's one way. Normal breathing or circulation of the blood of the person by applying pressure to the person's throat or neck or by blocking the person's nose or mouth. So you can see there's like 4 or so ways of committing the offense. 4 different kinds of ways. Keep in mind that they have to prove that pain was caused, right, as a part of this, because this, it doesn't say that there, but it's within the overall 2201 statute, which says that intentionally knowingly cause pain, and this is one way of causing pain. So, yes, sir? Nose or mouth. It is... I think if it's an issue of causing pain and covers the nose or mouth, it's chargeable as a third degree assault penalty violence. I think that's a fair way to argue it, kind of factually. So if the facts come up with there wasn't an impeding of breath, then I guess it would be up to the jury to make that call, don't you think? Yeah. So David's saying that the police make the call at the scene, whether they're gonna kind of work it up as a report and how they're gonna present it to the prosecutor. I think that happens where they're deciding how it's going to be charged. I think the prosecutor will look at it and kind of give it another eye too, right? So we take TCFV, just stepping into TCFV mode for just a second. We really do take strangulation suffocation very seriously. We really think that it's an indication of increasing severity of abuse. You can go from what was a Class C offense, an offense of touching, all the way to a capital murder in about 2 to 3 minutes, depending on how long it takes to kill a person. So it's really something that needs to be taken seriously on a level above what it had been before. The statute really just allows a possibility of another tool that prosecutors can use in helping to take the offense seriously. So I wanted to, can I show you these, and then let's talk. You know, none of what you said falls on deaf ears. We definitely take seriously. I take seriously what you're saying. I think it is definitely an educational component. Part of the TCFV works in policy. There's three teams at TCFV: policy, support to all of our constituent organizations, and prevention. And so one arm of TCFV is around prevention, working with men and boys, communities of faith, getting into the school systems, and just having the conversation about relationships, positive relationships, to get to the point where we're making it abnormal in the very first place from those folks, that from kids, teenagers, young adults, before it becomes normal to do to be violent in an intimate partner relationship. But having said all that, I think that we do. We definitely have a lot more work to do around making sure that people are aware. Here I am. I'm out here. I'm doing stuff. But I hear you. So I'll tell you, David, I'll get to you in just 1 second. During the ADIS session, HB 121 was a requirement that schools create a school dating abuse policy, and it has a whole series of things that school districts have to do in order to be compliant, to make sure that the teachers and the students know about the dating abuse policy in their school. We're looking at that for this next session to try and think of other ways to fold it in. I see him getting up. He's about ready to have me hush. So, David, I want to. So David asked a question about alcohol-related, and you know, I think as we think about it, we really think of alcohol as an exacerbating factor in a domestic violence situation, but not the cause of it, which is, I think, what you're asking is like whether it's a factor in the... Yeah, it's funny you ask that, because I know... So I don't know of a study that's at the state level. Yeah, exactly. David's like giving me some hints, right? At the state level where there's been a study like that, I know that I've heard of a couple of kind of smaller communities have addressed it, and I'll circle back with you if you want about it. All right, so I'm hushing up. Yes. Thank you, sir.